This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Guys, welcome to the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast. I'm excited about this one because we had an outreach out of nowhere saying, how would you like to have John Paul DeJoria on the podcast? And my immediate response was, who the F is this and why are you messing with us? So this man is a Navy veteran and an admiral in the Texas Navy, if I read that. Homeless two times in his life, and now a serial, just highly successful business leader. If you don't know who John Paul is, one, you're either refraining from reading and watching TV, or you live under a rock. John Paul Mitchell, the Mitchell System, which was wildly successful, and then Patron.
Yep. Paul Mitchell, Hair Care, and then Patron. Exactly. And more to come.
And more to come. How old are you now?
80. I'll be 80 next month.
You look great.
I feel great.
Well, I would expect, especially in the industry of health, you know.
Well, I'll go to be about 125 years old, and you will too. I'm also in other industries like medical industries, sales, things like that. But there's nothing in me now, but I'm in such good shape that I'll be able to easily go to 125. Easy. And you will too.
I believe it, given what you've accomplished. I want to go back. Well, first off, there is a line you use that I just love. Success unshared is failure.
That's so true.
And I don't know if that's going on your tombstone, but there is no better line than that.
Here.
And as I read it, I also thought to myself, failure unshared is also failure.
That's true. Very true.
But you didn't have the easiest upbringing.
Nope.
I mean, basically, you and your brother, raised by your mom.
That's correct.
I've heard you talk about your father. Just wasn't around.
Kind of a deadbeat dad.
Deadbeat dad. Yep. Have you forgiven him for that, or did you ever have conversations with him? Did you guys ever have a heart-to-heart?
The thing is, before I was 2 years old, my dad just split, left my mother with my brother and I, and we're first-generation American. My mother came over on a boat from Greece, an immigrant, so we just kind of struggled. I didn't see my father until I was 13 years old the first time, and there was no emotion. I really didn't feel very much for him, so there was nothing to forgive, because my mother more than took up the slack, and she was wonderful. We knew we didn't have a father. Obviously, the only time it really came up in my life I can't go to that, was in junior high school. We had a father-son night, sports night, and of course I had no dad to bring, so I didn't go to that one night, but it never really hit me hard, because my mom and my brother and I were very, very close. We got along fine, and my mom never talked bad about anybody, even my dad. We just knew that he just split and just disappeared. Then I saw him again when I was 22 years old, and then after I started Paul Mitchell, I went and I wanted to find him and just say, hey, buddy, just out of curiosity, what happened during those days? So now I'm into my 30s. Paul Mitchell's going for several years, so I'm making a little bit of money. So I fly up to San Rafael, California, where he is, and I find him. It took a while to find him, but I found him, and he was living in a barn with about 30 cats, and his wife at the time, who was his wife when my mom and he split up, right? Anyways, we went up there, and I looked at him. He was dying, and I said, you look terrible. I just told him, I said, look, with all due respect, you're my dad. We don't have an emotional connection because we've never been father or son. I said, but I'm doing pretty good in business now, and you really look bad. My mom is still ballroom dancing, and, God, she looks great. What happened to you? Very direct, He said, well, here's what it is. He says, and you can't help me at all in a voice like that. He said, the reason I'm like this is two packs of cigarettes and a pint of cheap whiskey every day for decades of my life. I ruined my own life. There's nothing we can do now. I'm going to be dying. And that's the last I heard. And then someone called me several months later and said he died. And that was it. Mm-hmm. That was the extent of it. So I forgive him because nothing to forgive. He was never really a dad. So I never really didn't like him. I just never knew him.
He just wasn't a factor.
No, not at all.
You grew up with your brother working jobs young.
Yep. Started very young. That's correct. We started first job 7 years old as an entrepreneur, then at 9 years old selling Christmas cards. And at 11 years old, I worked straight through there till right now. There was, of course, before school, we would deliver papers, fail the examiner, then work after school. And we just liked to work. The fact we even had a job that we could make money and give it to our mom so we could live a better life to us was wonderful. You know, maybe we kept $2 out of it a month. That was it for ourselves. But gave it to mom. We could live a better place. We could, you know, paint the walls, you know, with fresh paint instead of old paint. And, you know, we could eat a little better and maybe go to the miniature golf place on the weekends.
You know, when I read, you guys didn't have much. But one thing your mom instilled in you, and I read the story about she had a dime.
Yep.
And your brother and you were thinking, we could get 2 soda pops.
That's right.
With this, and she said, "No, go give it to that man who's working for the Salvation Army."
Now, can you imagine inflation? 1950, a big soda pop was 5 cents. Candy bars, 2 and 3 cents. But no, what happened was she gave us that dime and said, "Boys, hold half of it." It was a Christmas time. Put in that bucket, the man ringing the bell in the bucket, and we did. And we said, "Mom, why did we do that?" You know. Anyway, she said, "Well, boys, that's the Salvation Army, and there are people that have no food and no place to live. They help them out. So always remember, boys, as long as you live, though, we could afford a dime this year. We couldn't afford any more, but it's a dime." She says, "Oh, there's always someone that needs it more than you do. Always lend a helping hand in this life around." I said, "Mom, that's great. You know, it's wonderful," and I never forgot that.
She is, without a doubt, the rock in your life.
An angel. She was an angel. Very positive. No matter what happened, she looked to the positive side. In fact, and I like to share this with people, she wanted to make sure kids had everything. So one year, one night, she said, "Boys, we're going to eat like the millionaires." I said, "Oh, I don't know," because we lived on the wrong side of town, right?
In L.A.
L.A., Echo Park, East L.A., Atwater eventually. Anyways, so she had, it couldn't be any more than a 2-ounce piece of filet mignon steak, really, really little. But she bought a little piece of filet mignon steak, and she cooked it and cut in thirds and said, "Boys, that's called a filet mignon, and that's what the rich people eat. We're eating just like the rich people." Mom was cool. She was a good one.
So you got your 2 bites.
Exactly. And we didn't have a TV, so we didn't know anybody lived. You know, we eventually, I think, maybe around 1953, 54, 55, something like that, we finally got a little black and white TV. But the TV stations, there's only 3 of them in L.A., so we didn't know anybody else lived. We thought everyone was like Ozzie and Harriet, you know, and Ricky and his brother. They lived just a great life, you know, middle class great life. We didn't know about anybody else.
And then you finished high school.
Yep. Marshall High. I went into the Navy while I was in high school, the Naval Reserves. Legion Park had Naval Reserves going on there. You could join at 17 years old. If at 18, when you graduate, you went right into active duty. And that's what I did.
Did you have to go to boot camp?
Oh, yeah. San Diego.
Okay. Oh, they still had it in San Diego.
Yep, still in San Diego.
Not a bad place to be.
No, that's where I spent most of my military career. Oh, you were cold, right?
You were in the water.
Yeah. You were in Coronado, though, right?
Yeah, well, people don't understand. Well, the Pacific compared to the Atlantic is colder, but it's the wind chill. Yep. It's all the wind coming off the ocean that makes. If not Coronado, if you're dry, it's a beautiful place to be. I mean, it doesn't get that cold.
Well, I've been in there during Hell Week. I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
There's a way to make anything miserable.
Yep, true. Yeah. Really there. But
you and your brother joined as well, if I was correct.
That's correct.
And you guys were excited to join. You saw this as an opportunity.
Oh, my God. We never traveled, you know. We got to see the world. We both ended up on the same aircraft carrier, the USS Hornet, and had 2 Westpac cruises where we saw Hawaii, we saw Japan, we saw China, we saw the Philippines. We just thought we were the luckiest kids in the world. You know, like, wow, we get to see all this cool stuff. I bet nobody else does. You know, it was just really cool.
What did you learn from the Navy?
Well, what I learned from the Navy, in fact, when I received the Navy Lone Sailor Award in Washington, D.C. several years back, they wanted me to say, what did I learn in the Navy that, shall we say, got me really into helping civilian life out in others? And what I told them was this. I joined the Navy as just a normal person, nothing special. However, they teach you in the Navy and in other armed forces how to take ordinary people like ourselves and achieve extraordinary results if you work together as a team. And I learned that, and I didn't forget that.
And I haven't found it to that degree outside of the military yet. I'm sure it exists, and I know with, you know, with Paul Mitchell.
Paul Mitchell, we do a Patron Tequila, we do it. And now at Bandita, one of my newest companies, we're doing the same thing. Same thing. You know, we just work together as a team to accomplish it, and not any one individual stands out.
But it takes an amazing leader to build that culture.
And people around you that are also equal leaders.
Oh, yes, without a doubt. Leading at all levels. But somebody's got to set the tone.
Yes, we do.
So you also end up with a child at, you were 20?
20 years old, that's correct.
And I heard the story. Was it
a good one?
Well, it just, you know, for everyone who's, we're in interesting times.
Yeah.
COVID was damaging to a lot of people mentally.
Yep.
I mean, the economic conditions aren't the best right now.
That's correct.
Inflation's through the roof. Yep. Some people feel like there's just no hope. But what's amazing, you passed your wife who was coming down the stairs to the apartment. She said, I need to borrow the car.
Yeah.
You opened the door. Was it your son or your...
Yeah, my son. My little son was sitting there, 2.5 years old, once again, sitting there within a pile of clothes and a note, you know, saying, hey, I can't handle being a mom anymore. He's yours. But we got together very young. She was 19. I was 20.
Yeah.
You know, so by the time she was 20, I was 21. We had a baby. We were kids ourselves. So, you know, it was like, wow, that was really a bummer. What little money we had in the bank, she cleaned out, and we figured out a way to do it. I got a hold of a 1950 Cadillac from a relative that had a bent foot, hood on it, and a broken radiator that would leak all the time. I put water in every 4 or 5 hours. But we made it happen. We lived in the car. First time I lived in the car. Lived in the car twice. We lived in that car for a couple of weeks. And a dear friend of mine, Lee Meyer, who was a Hell's Angel, at that time was the Satan Slaves. We used to ride with them. I said, JP, come on in, live with us. Some of the mamas will take care of your son, and we'll loan you a bike to ride on the weekends. We'll give you a helping hand. So whenever people say, you know, well, the Satan Slaves are no longer around. They're now part of the Hell's Angels back in the 60s. They say, oh, these guys are a bunch of idiots, whatever. No, they're not. There's some big hearts in these guys, you know, that are, they're really, really cool. That'll help somebody out. They sure did for me.
Well, I think if you look at the historical foundation of the Hell's Angels, wasn't it a bunch of World War II vets?
Yep, that's right. Hollister, California. That's where they got going, I believe, somewhere up north.
Yeah, and they wanted to feel that tribe, that sense of camaraderie.
That's correct.
And we've talked about this before. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people go through life never really experiencing what we experienced in the military.
Yep.
But I mean, you look at the Hell's Angels, it provides the same thing.
Yep.
If you look at Al-Qaeda for impoverished Middle Easterners.
That's correct. It provides the same thing.
I'm not saying, you know, there's a difference between good and evil.
Sure.
But a lot of people just miss that or have never felt that sense of community. And I understand why people are naturally attracted to organizations, whether, again, criminal organizations or not.
Even the ones that are really criminal or those that are really terrorist organizations, that to be part of them makes them something. Even the gangs they have today, I'm something now. Instead of a nothing, I'm something, and I could eat, and I get all this extra things that I wouldn't normally get. And unfortunately, they're all brainwashed, especially some religious groups, unfortunately, to go the wrong way opposed to the good way. But by going the wrong way, they became even more famous, they think, which I think that's incorrect. It's much better, and they'd be even more famous if they did good things got the same fame, but they don't know that. They don't know any better.
So
I forgive them.
When you're homeless, you have your son.
Yep.
I mean, give me a sense of all the research I've done, people just describe you as, much like your mother, positive, always looking for the outlook or the good and everything. You know, you've talked about in the moment, use the resources you have.
Yep.
Don't worry about the past. You can't necessarily affect the future.
Can't change yesterday's newspaper. You can't.
I mean, you personally must have felt rock bottom at that moment.
Oh, a couple of times. That was the first time, like, oh my God, I've got a child. I have no money. She didn't pay the rent or utility bills for 3 months. We were ready to be evicted any day, and we were the next day evicted out of there. So it was very, very difficult. But we managed. We found the back seat of this car. It was a two-door, had more room for a child because he can lay straight. So he laid in back. I laid in the front, where I learned how to live in a car. You put your head by the steering wheel because there's all the room at the passenger side to flip over at night if you're sleeping. You learn a lot of how to live off 99 cents and a dollar, and how to get Coke bottles and cash them in and get 2 cents for the little ones, 5 cents for the big ones, and buy your groceries.
What was it, a moment, or what did you tell yourself? Because again, there's a lot of people feeling that right now, that Okay. There's got to be a period where you get in the fetal position. This has happened to me where I'm in the fetal position for 2 hours. I get up and I'm like, okay, I've sulked. What am I going to do about it? Was it somebody in your life at the time? Or did you just pull yourself up by the bootstraps and say, hey?
I wish there was someone in my life. My friend Lee Meyer helped out a lot by giving me a place to stay, needless to say. But no, my reaction was, what the heck is going on?
We got it. You can swear. It's okay.
What is going on? I don't believe this. And it took me a while. My first thought was transportation. She took the only car we had. How do I get a car? Phone still works, thank God. And I noticed all those notices that were there, nothing was paid. I thought, boy, we're on a real short string here to even be in this house. So my first thing was, okay, how do I get some money? Because I didn't have any money on me. How do I get some money? And I need a car. So I got hold of a car rather quickly, thank God. It was very, very lucky. And then where do I get money? I didn't want to borrow money from anybody. So, soda pop bottles. So I went around collecting them. In those days, every mark in every liquor store, this is the 1960s, okay? Every one of them had to take them and give you 2 cents for the little ones. And that's how I made that's enough money to live off of.
That's quite a story.
Yeah, it was a week before I got a paycheck from anybody, you know, but we made it.
So you held a number of jobs prior to meeting Paul Mitchell.
Oh, a whole bunch.
What, just give me a slew. I mean, you were...
I sold encyclopedias door to door. I drove a tow truck. I worked for a dictaphone. I worked for 7 Business Machines. I worked for Connecticut General. I worked for John Hancock. I worked for Medical Linen, just to name a few. That's a lot. I was just looking for my groove. And it was like, you know, what's really good for me? And if it wasn't satisfying over a short period of time, I knew I didn't want to stay here long term. So I would look until I found my thing. And then I worked for Time Inc., had a pretty good job for Time Inc. on the West Coast, where I was their circulation manager of sports, Sports Illustrated, Fortune, Life, and there was one other magazine. There was 4 magazines altogether. I ran a boiler room with 50 people trying to get people to resubscribe again. But it was cool. And I asked my boss, I said, hey, what do I have to do to be a vice president? I was 26 at the time. He said, well, first of all, you've never been to college and you're only 26 years old. Come back and ask me when you're 35. So I went to my friend John Capra, nicest man in the world. He was an employment counselor where people would hire him to get people into sales and other jobs. So John at one time had me go to 2 jobs where I would check in a dictaphone, for example, in the morning, right? And I'd make enough sales during that week and then 7 Business Machines in the afternoon to keep those jobs and 2 paychecks for a couple of months and able to buy, you know, a nice good little used car. And then that was going on. And then one day John said, you know what? He says, there's an opening. You're going to lose a little bit of money. It's not going to pay that much money. But, man, you go anywhere you want in this industry. So this is in the beauty industry. This one company is hiring salespeople, but you're going to take a loss in pay. You're making now about $850 a month. Now, remember, this is back.
Yes.
Okay. Anyways, in the 70s, that's what you're making a month. Now you only make about $650 a month salary and $100 and $25 car allowance. He says, but you could go to anywhere you want. I said, well, beauty industry, let's check it out. And he was right, because in a year and a half, I became their national manager of 2 divisions. And obviously 5 years later, went to work for another company for a couple of years, another one a year, and then started my own. So he was right.
Where does Paul Mitchell, where in the timeline do you meet?
Yeah, Paul was, when I worked at that time in the beauty industry, I started in 1971. And I met Paul Mitchell through a friend of mine, Eva Prang. We were at the big convention. She said, JP, you got to meet this hairstylist. He's the greatest guy. Your personalities match. You got to meet him. You'll be the best of friends. And we met and we were the best of friends. So when he'd come to California, he would stay in my house. When I go to Hawaii, I'd stay in his little bungalow. It was very, very little. And we were just really good friends. And then we started our own business together. And come 1980, we talked about it in 79 and 80, we started a business together.
Was it just like the perfect coupling?
Yeah.
He knew the beauty.
Well, he wasn't a businessman. He was a hairdresser. So he knew what a hairdresser needed and wanted in a product. And I had the formulation and people to work with to make incredible products. And that's what we did. He would test them, see how good they were. And then I would put the marketing and sales program together and we went into business. It was difficult, very difficult the first 2 years because our backer pulled. All we needed was money. We had no money. We were looking for $500,000 to start our company.
And we alone.
Had, yeah, just that's
what not investors loan.
No, just money. That's we needed that money from an investor. So we were giving the investor 40% of the business, and Paul and I 30% each. So we still had control, right?
Yes.
So I quit everything I was doing, all my little part-time jobs, anything I was doing, and went down the day of the money coming into Bank of America, and it never came in. So I got a hold of the fellow from Citicorp that put it together. He said, JP, unfortunately, the guy changed his mind. Now, this is interesting for your listeners. Why did he change his mind? Let's compare that to today, okay? 1980 and 81 also, by the way, inflation in the United States was 12.5%. Far more than it is today, right? Interest rates, if you could get a loan, prime rate was 17%, the lowest interest
That's
rate
you robbery.
Pay. Yeah, and we stood in line for gasoline. We had to wait around the block for gasoline.
Remember.
Yeah,
yes.
And our hostages were still in Iran. They hadn't been released yet in the early part of 1980. Mm-hmm. He said, it's a terrible time, last-minute decision, we're not going to do it. So long story short, we started the company with $350 each. I borrowed some from my mom, and that's how we started Paul Mitchell.
So you maintained 100% of the company between the two of you?
Yeah, 100%, exactly.
You guys have grown it.
Well,
I mean.
Well, yeah. Today, people ask you, when did you know you were successful? And I could say, I know the day exactly. We were in business 2 years. It was always hand to mouth. After 2 years in business, we were able to pay our bills on time. Not pay them off, but pay them on time and have $2,000 left over. We said, oh my God, this is going to be so easy to do right now. And but that struggling that we did, we ended up with the whole company. Main shareholder now. But anyways, another long story short is this. We started, it was tough. However, today, we are the largest privately owned salon hair care company in the world. So that little, let's gamble on ourselves. And it was tough. Those first 2 years were tough, my friend, because there were weeks where we just have any money. And I was still figuring, okay, how to live off $250, $2.50 a day. 99 cents at the Freeway Cafe for breakfast. And then 99 cents at El Torito during happy hour at 5 p.m, where you got all these little chicken wings and all the salsa. That was dinner. I learned how to go back to where I was before. And that happened quite a few times, but it worked out. We were okay.
You know, everyone loves to call themselves an entrepreneur.
Yep.
I think it's just the cool thing. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm my own boss. But there are tiers of entrepreneurs. Yep. I mean, most people in the situation you just described, most would say, hey, this isn't going to work out. We need to go get a guaranteed paycheck.
Sure.
What? Not guaranteed. We need to work
right.
for our money. I mean, both of you must have had moments where you're like, hey, are we making the wrong decision? Are we wasting our time? I mean, you endured pain.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely, definitely. When you think something's coming in, it's not. No, we definitely, you could feel it. And my partner, maybe a little bit more than me, he was just a little bit older than me, and was really counting on this one here, but it took a little while, but we got it, and it worked.
Was it confidence in your product?
100% confidence in our product, and I can say this for Paul and myself both, we both believed not only in the product, how good it would be, but if we could only have enough people test it, that's why we went through hairdressers, right, because they know products. Enough people could test it and feel it, then they'll reorder. We went into the reorder business. I tell people that. Don't go into the selling business. Go into the reorder business, where your product is so darn good that people want to reorder it, right, or tell somebody else about it. And that was very helpful with no advertising budget, no sales force, no nothing, just two guys.
And I got my MBA, and it's taken me 5 years to figure this out, and I still haven't figured it out. I'm one of those people that likes to call themselves an entrepreneur. I'm still struggling
are.
Very much.
And you are.
Paul eventually, if I'm mistaken, it was pancreatic?
Pancreatic, cancer? Yeah, 1989.
Were you with him?
Oh, yeah.
Most of those days?
Yep, sure was.
When he finally passed, which I'm sure was for the better, just the amount of pain he was
exactly.
in. What, personally, what did you go through when you lost? I mean, he's
well,
a partner.
We went through it a year before when we realized in his pancreas, gallbladder, and spleen were removed that he thought maybe he could possibly go for 2 years, but realistically, maybe a year. So Lars started switching things. So Paul was a great trainer. So we took the top five stylists he had trained to do platform work, how to train other stylists, and really went for them, made them like some headliners and shows we would do to start switch the to them. And Paul would show up at some of the shows himself and work with them. So we wanted to develop that team. We called them associates that would be out there. And then we started saying, okay, Paul, I'll just do everything I can right now to get more focus on me and off of you, which is what I did. Started doing ads, promotions, went everywhere to do whatever I could. So when Paul died, the industry said, okay, that's the end of it, because they named the product after him, a hairdresser, and he's not here anymore. And, you know, but we want to stay in the hairdressing industry somehow. It was, that's what we want to do. So I immediately said, no, we're going places. And Paul said to me before he died, we were all together in San Francisco at a beauty show, and he said, this is the last show he did several months before he died. He said, JP, I believe in the hereafter, and I want to be looking down from heaven or wherever the world I'm at, looking down on everything. And by gosh, I think we'd be able to be $100 million a year company one day. And I said, Paul, you'll be looking down and you're going to see that happen. Well, obviously we're a lot bigger than that, yes. But we made it. And that just made me really happy, even more drive to grow. He was a good man. He was a real good man.
I mean, from everything I've read, I mean, you speak so highly of him, but people also speak so highly of you. I mean, the word mentor from even people you probably haven't met within the company.
Yep.
It's mentorship from afar, merely by your message. And that's powerful. I mean, I've never had that. Maybe never will, but there's something you've developed in your leadership style and how you build the cultures and the teams that just resonates. And the fact that I'm sitting here with you, and I'm not one to blow smoke. Will, you're in the presence of greatness.
Thank you.
There he goes. He's at it.
Very kind.
Two more questions. Well, let me ask this. I've seen so many people come together to start a company, partners,
right,
co-founders, where one leaves and one continues on with the company. It seems like it is a minority for two original founders to remain close and do business together. Mm-hmm. It's just there's something about it that's strange, especially from where I came in the special operations community.
You've got to pick your partners.
And that's an art.
Yeah, but special ops is a little bit easier, because special ops is the top 1% could become a SEAL, and the top 1% of the SEALs could ever become special ops. But there, they choose the people. They pick the people outright, knowing that they're tough people. They're individuals. They could think on their own, but they could also get along with one another. And you depend your life on the other guy. You're both depending on one another for your life, and you're sincere, like real brotherhood. And that's so true. That is so true.
You and Paul ever have major disagreements?
Never. And one of the reasons why was, number one, we were pals for 9 years before we started our business, so we really knew each other. And second of all, I didn't do hair and he didn't do business. There was nothing to ever argue about. Anything dealing with hair, hey, Paul, you're right.
So you guys almost defined very clear, I'd say, swim lanes.
Yeah, we actually...
Okay, I've got this and you've got this.
Actually, we didn't have to.
Because
it was already known. It was already known. Yeah, we didn't have to. Never had even talked about it.
How important was it to you and Paul to keep the company private? Because I have no doubt you've had multiple offers.
Largest amounts ever were offered to us that paid for any company of our type. And I decided many years ago, and Paul decided too, that we're always going to stay somehow in the professional beauty industry. So even during COVID, where many states shut down salons for several months, just shut them down, no business. And Amazon, we finally went with Amazon, but we cut a little special deal with them that on Amazon, anyone that was selling Paul Mitchell, quite a bit of it, was counterfeit or black market or out the back door, that they would eliminate all that because it wasn't clean business.
No,
we would go on with them, and then we would take, and they helped us out with this by giving us the zip codes and everything. Everyone that bought through Amazon a product, we would know the zip code where they bought it from, and then we would give a double-digit part of our profits right back to those salons in products and education, whatever they wanted, we would give it right back. So we would always stay in the professional beauty industry. So if you see Paul Mitchell in a drugstore or supermarket, we don't sell it to him. In fact, we're trying to deal right now with a big chain, one of these giant chains, and I can't mention their name now, I'm under confidentiality, but it's a real big chain nationwide, and it's not a supermarket or a drugstore, but a big chain, big all everything market, to be able to, they want to be able to sell, reorder things on behalf of the salons. Like if someone, not a professional hair care color or professional product salon would use, but like shampoos or conditioners to take home, they would put on their shelf. And they said, well, the only reason we would do that, if you wanted to do it, is if you had a big sign that promoted salons, told people to go to salons and let them know that part of their profits are going right back to the salons. And they agreed to that, which was really great. So we're looking at doing something with them.
That
in
is
other
cool.
words, everything we do, we promise salon industry, no matter how it changed, we'd always make sure the beauty professional beauty salon industry would benefit by everything we do with Paul Mitchell products.
All right, here's coming the leap. Some business leaders do extremely well in one industry.
Yep.
Try to make the leap to another.
Yep.
And fall flat.
Yep.
So one was tequila.
Yep, always Patron, the drink of choice. Patron, exactly.
Was tequila a drink of choice for you?
Yeah, what it was I was building a house for my family, like a little retreat to go to. And while I was doing it, my contractor, who I knew for a long time, a friend, brought this fellow by name Martin. Said, this is Martin. He's a really nice man. He just went bankrupt in the hospitality industry. He's a good architect designer. He'd like to start an architectural business where he goes to Mexico, buys furniture, things of that nature, comes back to the States and sells it to restaurants or architects for model homes. It's a niche market. I said, oh, I'll back the guy up. I was doing good. So I was the bank. I backed him up. And after 1 year, we were doing okay, but nothing really major. So I said, well, next time you go down there, which he goes down on a regular basis, I'm building this house here, but we were drinking tequila at the time, right? And we did the salt thing, you know, take a swig of the salt, you know, salt, lime, everything. Anyways, I said, bring back a couple bottles of what the aristocrats drink. It's got to be smoother than this, you know. Maybe they have something you just drink straight. He went down there and bought the stuff. And then when he came back, he brought these two bottles with him of this tequila. And it was the smoothest I had ever tasted. He said, JP, I met a guy named Francisco Alcaraz. He's the chef of tequilas. He can make it a little bit smoother. I said, really? Well, tell you what. I'll bankroll it, and I'll go into business with you, and I'll be the marketing end of it with you and sales end, okay? So we went in that business, and I bought 1,000 cases, 12,000 bottles, and brought it back to the United States. Nobody would touch us. Not because of the quality of the product, but they said, the average tequila is $5 a bottle. You guys have to charge almost $37 a bottle for your product. You know, it's just too expensive. No distributor would touch us. This is interesting. So we finally talked to a wine guy who only sold wine, period, and convinced him to take us on. If he would take us on, we'd give him Spago's restaurant in his account and Baja Cantina Marina Del Rey as an account, right? Well, we already talked to Wolfgang Puck and Baja Cantina. They always say, yeah, we'll take it. Of course we'll take it. This is the best kid we've ever had. So after 1 year, we dropped them. All they sold was 1,000, I think, 200 cases for the whole year. We thought we could do better. So we went with a real big company like Jim Beam. They're a big company, right?
Massive.
We would cut them in, and they in return would get all their distributors, who in return would get all their accounts, right? Just cut one more guy into it. And after a couple years with them, we went to them and said, guys, you're doing about 12,000 cases a year. We think we could do 50,000 eventually. What do you think? They said, let us tell you the truth. Gentlemen, we like you very much, but you'll never do more than 20,000 cases a year because, one, it's too expensive. You have the best stuff there is, but people just aren't paying that kind of money for it, you know? So we dropped them and went with Seagram's. And Seagram's took it up to about 70,000 a year, all right? And we thought, well, that was pretty good, you know? But we could do better. So we went to court with them and bought them out in court. We actually bought them out in court, and we took it over ourselves. So what I want your listeners to know is, the line that nobody would took on because it's no expensive. The line that people said, you only do so much because you're too expensive, right? You're just too much. Don't believe people in what they say. When I sold Patron a little over 5.5 years ago, we were doing a little over 3,500,000 cases a year. No one's ever done that before, just all record type breaking, you know. So, you know, you believe in what you have and you go for it and you work at it. And that's exactly what we did because we liked the product. Once you tasted Patron, you reorder that because it was totally different than anything else, like one of the greatest thing. And I fed, I had another tequila at the time when I sold it called Bandero. And Bandera was like ultra smooth, but when I sold the company, I couldn't sell that. So they gave me a 5-year non-compete, but let me keep it, which was really nice of them to do. I got to keep the line. So I gave it to my daughters for very little money. And when my 5 years was up, which was last year, I jumped in, and now we're in 7 states, including Texas. In fact, here in Texas, my God, Twin Liquors has it, Specs has it, and we're starting to grow out there with different restaurants and such. It's very exciting.
All the places my wife and I go.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, well, ask for Bandero.
I know my wife is a tequila drinker. Not right now. Great. She's pregnant.
Oh, so, okay, sure.
We're monitoring that.
I'll make sure you get a bottle to let her taste when she's not pregnant anymore. You could taste it in the meantime. If you could drink the whole thing in the meantime, guys. I wish I would have known that would have brought a bottle or two.
Oh, she's big time. I mean, it seems like right now, every movie star is starting a line.
Oh, my God.
It's like everyone's jumping into the space from The Rock to, I mean, Ryan.
Oh, The Rock. Oh, you want to, my God, look at Matthew McConaughey.
Yes.
And then, of course, my friends, Michael Millman from Discovery, along with Randy Gerber, you know, the fabulous fellow. And, of course, George Clooney. They started their Casamigos, and they sold that before I sold mine. And several of there's a lot. In fact, there's over 200 what they call premium tequilas for sale in the market now in the United States. So you got to be different. So how do we make ours different, right? Why is Bandero different? It's ultra smooth. It's already won 7 gold medals. It's organic, and there's no additives, and it's in a recycled glass bottle. And even the leather that covers the outs, beautiful packaging, isn't real leather. We were able to find some that looks like leather, smells like leather, feels like leather, but you don't have to kill a cow.
With Paul Mitchell and Patron and all these other companies, are you relentless when it comes to the actual product?
Oh, definitely. Even at Paul Mitchell, he still sent me samples to try. As long as it's not a hair color or permanent wave or a bleach, I'll try it, you know, and give him my comments on it, and the packaging too.
Do some people think you're rigid in that sense of you just won't relent on quality and...
No, it's just that, but everyone, our whole group, our whole team knows that. So my daughter now, Michaeline, is the CEO of the company. She runs the company now. And her and everybody around her comes from that background. It's got to be great. The customer's got to like it. The hairdresser must love it. And whatever it does must enhance the hairdresser. And the customer want it enough to come on back and reorder. That's how we do things. And that's how everybody grows up in the industry.
This is
at least with my company.
This is a very broad question, but... So again, between the two companies and all the ventures you've run, what are the common threads that you consider to success?
Very good question. Number one is make sure your product is of such quality, people want to reorder it or tell somebody else about it, okay? Number two, make sure whatever you do with your product, it does the greatest good for the greatest number of people as well as the environment. Price it realistically with people. And remember rule number one. Rule number one is the customer is always right. Rule number two, if you have to go to rule number two is go back to rule number one. And that's a big deal because your customer is buying it. So no matter whether they're right or wrong, they're right. And they have a reason for being right, even if they're wrong. So you just hear them out and you try and fix it.
Do you think that's where a lot of companies go wrong?
Yep.
They become the big giant.
I've seen that happen. Yeah. And all of a sudden you go on the phone to call them and you have to wait 10 minutes for somebody to come across and give you the phone or someone to even answer it. You know, we're very personal. Like, I don't have email. I don't even turn a computer on. My companies are all state-of-the-art technical companies. In fact, I have a big technical AI company right now, but I don't even have email. If you were to send an email, you'd have to find my secretary or my assistant to get it to. If you can even get her number, then she gives it to me, and I'll either write on the email and have her send it back to you or pick up the phone and call you. We're very personal with people.
Yeah, it seems like that is a dying art.
Yeah.
Everything, you know, you can only get so much from email. You definitely can't get contacts. You're definitely not building relationships. And you're right. It seems like every company, you've got to wait, you know, 45 minutes.
You're
never even going to talk to
them. You don't get them, exactly.
You don't even get a human being.
It's not right.
Or, no offense, it's an overseas call attendant.
Person, yeah.
I get it. Cost cutting. I know the environment is big to you. You just brought it up. I do love this one. Maybe it's we both share a common service, the Navy, water.
Yep.
You're big into... conservation of the seas.
That is correct. I just bought Captain Paul Watson his second big ship to go after the illegal whaling that's going on in the seas.
How big?
Oh, this is a big one. It's about 300 feet. And the last one I bought was about 250 or 60 feet for him.
Now, is it
It's a captain. It was a Sea Shepherd, but he had left and started the Captain Paul Watson Foundation. I bought the Sea Shepherd when he was there, a couple of boats also. Great crew, by the way. But Captain Paul Watson wanted to be a little more aggressive, and he needed some bigger boats to do it with. And he's relentless. I mean, he wants to save those whales from extinction, and he's doing a damn good job of it. So I support him. Bought him when he left. Didn't have the money, so I just bought him his first ship and gave him his first startup money. And then that was just a couple of years ago. And just bought him his last ship that we just took possession of. I'll tell you the story. It's really funny. Want to hear a funny story? Okay, it's mainly the Japanese whalers he go after. So Whale Wars, his television show, was, you know, all about going after the Japanese whalers. The last boat that I bought, I just found out, was a Japanese whaling boat. He sent somebody else into Japan to buy it. They delivered it to Korea, and then the Cotton Paul Watts Foundation took the flag down, put their flag up, and took it over. There's nothing they could do. So we're using one of their boats. That's a fast one. That's a big one. It's almost 300 feet. To chase their boats down if they go into illegal whaling again. No disrespect to the Japanese, but there's a certain group there that do a lot of illegal whaling, yes. And I don't even know how they get away with it. It's just terrible. So I guess we're the only people that help curb it.
Ooh, that is a dangerous job. I mean, emotions get high on both sides.
Yep, that's correct.
Has anyone ever been killed? I mean, there's some collisions, isn't there?
We never really collision with our boat. They run into us, not where we run into them. So only one time I think a boat cut in front of us, and we're trying to save this dolphin group in Mexico, but they cut in front of us purposely, and of course it hit the boat, which was crazy. But it's normally us that get it from them. But the closest I think we've ever gotten was we're between two whaling boats, and they come together with our smaller boat in between the two. It's like, oh no. And Paul Watson at one time chained himself to a giant anchor, right? And the idiots, unreasonable people that had the boat, would drop the anchor and then pick it up. They would drop him down for like 30 seconds and bring him back up again. But he just stood his ground. They finally let him go before they killed him. So, yeah, it's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, we were on the boat. My daughter, Alexis, the race car driver, Alexis DiGioia, unbelievable. 335 miles an hour from a dead stop in 3.8 seconds. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Anyway, she was on the boat with me for one whole week in the Bay of St. Lawrence, and we saved, they estimate, about 100,000 baby harp seals that are all white from being clubbed to death.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, we stayed on the boat with them all that time. We broadcast off the boat every day on Canadian radio. Every day we broadcast, and you could see 10 miles away the boat circling, but no one came near us. And Paul just said, JP, it was about 100,000 we saved that week. That Brigitte Bardot was into it a long way, a big, big way, until she got a little bit, I think, too old to be able to do that anymore. But my daughter and I were on the ice doing it, broadcasting away and saying, you know, you guys come, you got to club us first before you club the seals. And we were lucky, hopefully, you know, we're a week on that boat, nobody got hurt, no clubs, no baby harp seal died, and nobody got clubbed. Mm.
Is it Japanese law does not allow that? These are outlaws from...
Oh, no, Japan. No. That the baby harp seals were in Canada. They were Canadians. Yeah, but the whales, I think the Japanese government's behind it because they put out a warrant for Paul's arrest for interfering.
Oh, you're kidding
me. And they said, oh, they're only research. This is just for research. You need 200 whales for research, but how's that end up in the sushi bars? Mm. You know, for luxury sushi, people pay a little more for that? Mm-hmm. Come on. But I guess the industry in Japan, you know, is really supports the government. So if you're one of the who's who, I guess it works, you know. And again, I think the Japanese, as time goes on, at least the people become more aware of this and say, this is not the thing to do. And I think they're smart, educated people, or eventually they'll realize it's just not worth it. It's like what they did with the Cove. Did you ever see that documentary, The Cove?
No.
Oh, my God. It came out about 10 years ago where they in Japan were pulling together in this little cove all these dolphins. And then shutting it off, they would bring them in there, right? They herd them up, shut it off till they can't get away, and went in the water and clubbed them all to death.
Documentary?
Yeah, documentary. It's called The Cove.
The Cove.
Unbelievable. They were special ops people, I think, that went in there to plant the cameras for them, you know, or sailors that went in and planted the cameras. One of the best things there, it's unbelievable documentary. It's called The Cove. And they exposed, because they had hidden cameras in there and showed it all. They denied it, but they said, yeah, well, we have it on film. And I think that stopped it for a while. Hopefully they're not doing that anymore. Maybe they are, I don't know. Yeah. But publicity stops a lot of these things that aren't proper.
We were in Alaska. God, it was close to the October 7th because I remember doing TV hits for the whole Israel Hamas. Yeah. But we went out on a tour boat. Mm-hmm. Whales. Yeah. Beautiful. I mean, Alaska is just untouched. Yeah. And to see that, I think more Americans need to get up there.
Yes, they do.
Just to see it. And it just... There's something so peaceful about the sea life, as well as the Alaska terrain. Oh, yeah. It just you detach for a bit. Yeah,
you're living to God's country up there.
Yeah.
That's good.
What do you have coming up?
Well, Bandero Tequila, we now have in 7 states, and that's very, very exciting. But other than that, I'm in other industries, too. I'm in the industry, let's call it of longevity, working with a great, great group of doctors here that are into gene splitting. The other group is into cells, and then from the cells, taking various things that are put back into your body after they're cleaned up to make you healthier. And there's so many things going on now in medical science. And I can tell you this is a fact. Just stay healthy as can be, because the average person now that stays very healthy will live to be way over 100. I'll go to at least 125, even more.
Centurions. Yeah. In terms of the product development,
well,
are you guys
in product development? Yeah, well, these are more like, you know, products to use on your skin or on your hair. Mm-hmm. But other areas that I'm into also, and I'll come back on your show in about 3 months and tell you more about it. The entire executive team that we had at Patron Tequila, all their non-competes were up last year also, and we're starting another company, bringing out another beverage that no one's ever brought out before. It's like something brand new in the beverage market, but until May, I can't talk about it. Okay, but
it's cool.
But I'll tell you about it. I'll come and give you bottles and tell your guests about
it. So you poached all your high performers back?
Yeah, they all wanted to. We all had to wait 5 years, and we just got together, and we call it second round two. That's our round two.
The band's back together. Yeah,
exactly. But other than that, we do have other things. For example, I'm an AI. And I don't even have email, but I understand business and how it runs. I have experts that work with me. It's called VanDidIt, like V-A-N, did, D-I-D, it, E, VanDidIt. And what we did is in the return industry, where people return things to retailers or manufacturers who have overruns, they want to get rid of the stuff. So they discount everything to a big warehouse at big discounts, because that big warehouse has to discount it to someone else who has to discount it to somebody else. We found a way. It took me several million dollars and a few years with this genius that is one of my partners named Gary Stevens. We worked together, right? Anyways, and he was a genius behind putting it together. So several years later, several million dollars. We go from the return goods, and 1 in 6 are returned, by the way, in the retail market. Is that amazing? 1 in 6 are return goods. There or a manufacturer with an overage, and take them at no charge, no charge. So why wouldn't you want to try it? Directly to the end person that buys it. So instead of having something they lose money on, these companies lose hundreds of millions a year just on things they want to try and get rid of, because you can't just throw them away. So now something that was worthless is now valuable, and it goes directly and it bypasses everybody. And we have the AI, and we just introduced it at a big event, a big communications and Renew Logics type of a show in Las Vegas, Nevada in January. And right now we have 4 or 5 months of a waiting list of people that want to get on it,
because no
there's no charge. We make our money when the person buys at the other end, then the manufacturer gets their cut, and we get our little percentage. We're happy.
You know, so many people are just fearful of AI. Yeah. And it was actually the Rogan podcast. I can't remember who the guest was. And I love AI. I've been using it. I think we've been using it to the full degree, because it speeds things up. But AI won't replace humans.
Nope.
But humans that use AI will replace humans that don't. That's the quote.
Yeah, but that's a good quote. Yeah,
that's
Joe Rogan, by the way, is my neighbor.
You know,
he lives a couple doors from here.
You see him quite a bit?
He is a great guy. Joe is really cool. What I like about Joe is he really, many things, he's a straight shooter. But
yes.
My wife and his wife have known each other for maybe 30 years or something like that, maybe longer.
Have you gone on his podcast yet?
No, I haven't yet. No, but I will eventually go on there. Yeah, get on there.
I went on once with a buddy.
Yeah,
cool. It was interesting. Insane to go on Joe Rogan's podcast. My buddy has a big following. I do not. Yep. But it was good to see it behind the scenes.
But he didn't start with a big following. He started little and build. You know, you will do the same thing, sir.
Yeah, just give me time. Yep. Give me time. There's no hacks, no shortcuts. Yep. In terms of philanthropy, I know we before we started recording, you know, vets have to take care of vets.
That's true.
And along the lines of helping those around you.
That is correct.
You've done quite a bit within the vets.
Yes, I have.
Close to here, and I know this is specific to Austin. You started on a local scale, Patriot Hall.
That is correct.
Just explain for the audience what Patriot Hall is.
Patriot Hall is, and it's just a wonderful place. It's right in between Driftwood and Dripping Springs, kind of in between there on the highway. But there was a Veterans of Foreign War little location where everyone went to that was that closed down. It was part of a church. They just closed them down. And here we had all these veterans, some injured, some weren't, that, you know, just needed a place to hang out instead of watching TV at home all the time. So this wonderful lady, Catherine, came to me and said, JP, through Constance, who had something like Peace, Love, and Happiness Foundation, we're trying to build this facility where veterans can come. Number one, we'll have somebody there full-time that shows them all the benefits they have. And most veterans don't know all the benefits they have. There's a lot of benefits, right? And more important, a place to hang out where we'll have couches, we'll have things for them to do, obstacle courses. I mean, where they have their place. This is brilliant. My God, we need this. So obviously, I gave her whatever it took. And then they built the first building. And then I came back and gave them a little bit more. And we're building another building, another building. And my God, we even had a guy there from World War II, an oldie but goodie that was there. Is still alive, right? It just, he just loved me. That was the greatest thing in the world because we take care of our own. And it's a shame. It's a shame, not just with Vietnam, but just with vets everywhere from everywhere, is our government doesn't do enough for them, and we the people don't do enough for them. And they're putting their asses on the line and their lives for our way of life. And even those that didn't believe in what was going on in Vietnam, they still ended up getting drafted, and they were there and gave it for the rest of their life. They could have died there, and there was no rest of their lives. And when they come back, people kind of shut them. I think anyone that signs up with the idea of doing something good for my nation, and I'll put my life right there in front of everybody else and lose it if I have to, is unbelievable. They should be really taken care of. They should be getting a lot more than they get today. A lot more.
Do you still recommend service to country to, I mean, would you, to young Americans?
No, I would leave that up to every individual. I found that works a lot better. Some people, it works good in their life. Some people, it doesn't. It'd be up to each individual.
Yeah, that's true. I loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, without the military, I couldn't imagine my 20s or 30s. I say I don't miss the circus. I miss the clowns.
Yeah.
I miss the guys.
Oh, yeah.
That was the greatest part. I don't care what you threw at us. I had 40 hardcore, just like-minded, not groupthink.
Right.
Who said, no matter what's thrown at us, we will figure out a way.
That's right.
And that's rare.
And we do. We do.
You know, in we had talked additionally for the audience, we've got a documentary called The 777 coming out in May. And I'm nervous as hell. But we got Dan Myrick, who did the Blair Witch Project.
Yep.
He's directing it. You know, there's a great line in there from one of the guys. He says, you know, if you go up to an average American and ask him one person that died in the Vietnam War or Iraq or Afghanistan, they won't be able to name anyone.
Right.
Pat Tillman. Okay, that doesn't count. Pat Tillman was a famous football player.
Of course.
And they can't. Yep. And that doesn't sit well with me. I don't want to throw it in anyone's face.
Sure.
That's not how we are. Mm-hmm. But the idea that freedom isn't free.
Right.
That somebody had to pay the cost.
That is correct.
And it is heart-wrenching to see these vets come back, regardless of Vietnam, though we were very welcomed compared to the Vietnam generation.
Of course.
When my generation complains, I'm like, hey, go do your research on Vietnam. It's just a difficult transition. And to set up Patriot Hall just somewhere where they can go with other people going through that that saves lives.
And I've gone down to Coronado with the Navy SEALs that are starting to get out of that. They're going to get out in a year or two. And I hold classes for them down there on, you know, how to take your Navy SEAL training and what you got out of the military and apply to civilian life, and how to gear your resume with what you did, not just Navy SEAL or Special Ops. What did you do, and what did you do that could apply to anything they have? You know, my God, we are some of the best guys on computers, on communication equipment, on getting from one location to another, on logistics. I mean, unbelievable talents. But they never knew that. So I showed them from a businessman how they could do it themselves when they get out. And I just love that. I've got a few letters from a few of them that said, JP, I'm so happy.
Well, they've got to hear it from you. They've got to hear it from a vet.
Someone that did it.
Has represented all of us to the highest degree.
That's correct.
Was that the Honor Foundation?
Nope.
Okay. There's a great organization called the Honor Foundation that holds these transition classes. But that's huge. That's huge to hear from a vet. And thank you.
Sure. My pleasure. My pleasure.
Well, JP, we're going to have you on in 3 months because now
I got some cool to show you.
Okay. we'll just bring the product. We'll put it in Men's Journal because one of the biggest things with Men's Journal is alcohol.
I get great. It.
It's the strangest thing.
Oh,
it's the strangest thing. They love to advertise alcohol. Well, sir, I know everyone's trying to get your time. The fact that you've given us an hour, thank you for that.
It's my pleasure.
I do have to ask you, what are the three lessons that you would impart on anyone listening to this on how to live a good, impactful life?
Good question. Number one, be kind to one another, even jerks. Be kind to one another. Number two, whatever you do in your personal life or your business life, don't be in the selling business. Be in the reorder business, even if it's with yourself personally and your spouse or someone you want to impress. Be such a good pal or such a good partner that they'll want you around a lot or see you a lot, you know, time after time after time. The third one is the biggest one, and I can explain it. Be prepared for a lot of rejection in your life. The example is when I sold encyclopedias door-to-door. Collier's Encyclopedias in the latter part of the mid and latter part of the 1960s. Collier's door-to-door. Commission only, no salary, no leads. You knock on doors, here's your briefcase, go for it, right? They gave you a little training program that you were not paid for, okay? But they said this, if you knock on 50 doors and they're all closed in your face, be just as enthusiastic on door number 51 because you're going to be, you know, that's what's going to make it. You know, you're going to get rejection as long as you know that. Now, the average lifespan of an encyclopedia salesman selling door to door on commission only is 3 days. After 3 days of no, 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 what are you doing here? What, you're selling books? Get out of here. I mean, whatever, right? That was it. Well, I lasted selling encyclopedias for about 4 years, okay? But I believe what they said. So for me, it wasn't door 51, it was door 101. Finally got through the first door, gave a presentation, didn't get it, but eventually I got it. And then eventually, little by little, I could give three or four presentations to get at least one out of every three. In other words, be prepared for rejection. You get rejection. You're too young. You're too old. Nobody likes you. You're too fat. You're too skinny. You don't have any money. Every objection you could ever get in the world, don't let it get you down. Because if you know in life, you're always going to run across rejections one way or another, and you know it. You take it with a grain of salt. Okay, I understand, but I'm going to go straight ahead anyways. Thank you. It's like telling us a patron, you'll never sell more than 20,000 cases a year. Or at Paul Mitchell, you're out of your mind. You're starting a company in the cosmetic business against these biggies like L'Oreal, like Redken, all the big ones, Lean Curtis, the biggies, right? There's no way you're going to, it's impossible. You have no money? Impossible. Impossible. You're not going to, it's not going to happen. And we did and became the largest.
For me personally, I think I'm going to lean into number three a little more.
Yeah.
I know that's the truth.
Yeah, hang in there.
In the moment, hard to swallow.
If you believe it, you just hang in there, buddy. You believe, you just hang right on in there.
Amen. There's no better way to end than that, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast. Until next time.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.